It's a bit of a funny story for the seminar, because I was here last year to give a similar talk and got maybe 10 minutes through the talk effectively, because we got bogged down in discussion about whether about semi-classical gravity. So Giffrey invited me to come back to continue the talk, and since then he's left. So I'm going to still obviously proceed as if none of you have, with the assumption that almost all of you have not, were not here last year. But I will also try and move towards to get beyond the first 10 minutes and actually get to the set of equations that we're interested in. Great. So I was actually going to, I'm going to first pop up an ad to say that there's a deadline in about a week for It for Qubit postdocs, and there's also studentships available. There should be a link on my website if people are interested in this kind of general field of quantum information theory applied to quantum gravity. Good. So this is joint work with Joan Camps, Barbara Soda, who's actually here, and you can probably ask her if you have further questions about the work presented here, Carlos Barquiera, and Zach Weller-Davies. And I was trying to decide whether I could give a chalk talk or use the PowerPoint. I'll use the PowerPoint maybe for now, and then maybe swap. Good. So the question I want to ask effectively is, do we need to quantize gravity? It's a question that people have gone back and forth with for ages. I don't have a strong opinion on whether we should quantize gravity or not. There's arguments for and against it, and there's no-go theorems for and against. There's various no-go theorems that are out there. I merely want to explore the possibility of whether it's possible to have a classical theory of gravity coupled to quantum fields, and then if it is, I want to just explore the consequences of that. So, because I'm a quantum information person, I like quantizing everything I can see, so there's a part of me that really wants to quantize gravity. But there's, I think, some really nice consequences if we decide not to. And I guess part of the motivation for why we might consider not quantizing gravity is it seems that gravity is different to the other fundamental forces. So we have matter, various quantum fields, they live on a space-time. And when we think of the kinds of measurements that we perform in the lab, what we do is we have some initial data on a Cauchy surface. It evolves later in time, and we perform some measurement at some later time. And it seems in all the kinds of measurements we can do that what we're doing is we're performing measurements at definite times, at particular positions, and we need that space-time structure in order to actually know what we're doing. So somehow we're always measuring fields at a point X at a time t. And therefore, there's kind of some reason why you might imagine that space-time itself should remain classical even as we quantize the fields. But you can come up with reasons either way. So I guess the main message here, so this slide just has the central, like all you need to know for the talk, or the key messages that I'll get across. The messages are essentially that you can have a classical systems that interact with quantum systems. That's possible, even despite the many no-go theorems which tell you that's impossible. So that's the first major headline, I suppose. The other thing is, if you have a quantum system coupled to a classical system, then you necessarily get collapse of the wave function, or the emergence of classicality, or real, sometimes called the reality problem. You have a notion of classicality, and classicality, quantum systems necessarily become classical if they're interacting with the classical system. So If you assume that space-time is classical, you get for free, collapse of the wave function. The second thing you get for free is that you necessarily have to have information destruction. Now, some people might not like that, but I think that black holes destroy information. I think that's kind of the most logical outcome of the black hole information problem. And so you, in a natural way, get information destruction. So I would regard that as a bonus of the theory. And finally, you get, I think, an effective theory. Because I think it's possible if I have two quantum systems. Those are, I guess, the key things. I have, if I assume that space-time is classical, I can have a consistent theory. It will necessarily cause collapse of the wave function, and you will necessarily have information destruction. Now, you might not want to still regard this theory that I'm going to present as fundamental, but it does. If you don't, that's fine, because I think it does provide an effective theory, kind of a classical limit of quantum gravity. So you might imagine there's an actual quantum theory of gravity out there, and because we're mostly performing measurements of fields at points in space and time, it's natural to want to take the limit where space-time is itself classical. And so this provides a consistent way to examine those kinds of questions. So an effective theory where space-time is classical. And what's nice is that I think until now there was not a good way to study that limit. So study the limit where we have quantum fields and they back react onto space-time. Okay, so I guess the first question I want to ask with regard to this notion that if you have a classical system and it interacts with a quantum system, you necessarily get an emergence of classicality. I guess I would ask the following question. In the measurement problem, or the Schrodinger cat problem, or whatever you want to call it, we tend to believe that somehow, even though on some scale we have quantum mechanics, at some macroscopic scale we have classical mechanics, or the notion of a classical state emerges. And I guess I would ask the question, does it make sense to even ask the question of how classicality emerges if we don't have a notion of what a classical system is? So somehow, we should, does it make sense to talk about emergence of classicality if you don't have a system which is fundamentally classical? So for example, if I have a Schrodinger cat state like 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, then people often think of that as a classical state in the sense that if I make any local measurements, it looks classical. But in many other regards, it's still a quantum state. So if I make some very almost impossible collective measurement, I can reveal the phase between the zero state and the one state. And I can also measure in different bases. So I don't have to measure in the 0-1 basis. I can also measure in the plus minus basis. So I guess I have a feeling that if I want to really talk about the notion of classical emergence, I really need classical systems in order to do that. Because if everything is quantum, then there's just no such thing as a classical state, and there's no way to fully get a kind of a classical emergence coming from that. Yeah.
Can I say that I don't understand that argument? It sounds like we should never have hydrodynamics because there's no fundamental hydrodynamics. But it emerges at some scales.
Right. I guess I don't necessarily. So there's various thought experiments that you might be in many worlds you might have a many worlds interpretation and say that effectively, so you might say effectively, this looks classical for all intents and purposes. I don't strongly disagree with that. It may be that what we think is objective reality is not really, and that just our mind is playing tricks on us and things can get undone. There's some indication, though, that that's impossible. So there's these papers by Renato Renner and some of his students, where they look at thought experiments and they apply, for example, can you apply your favorite interpretation of quantum mechanics to you, for example, performing measurements? And they say that there's an inconsistency in that. And I'm sympathetic to that. To that argument, that there'll be a fundamental inconsistency if we try and apply your favorite interpretation to, if we apply it to you yourself. So I don't have a strong feeling, but I think there's an argument that can be made either way. I guess what I would say, though, is if you do have a fundamentally classical object, then it becomes clear to me. Like, so if you have an object that's fundamentally classical, then the fact that objectivity and classicality emerges, that becomes very natural and definite in some way. Whereas this kind of effective emergence of classicality feels a bit murky to me. It's associated with all kinds of problems, like why this particular basis or this and that. So, we can have a long discussion about the measurement problem and various interpretations, which probably is not appropriate, but I guess I would just say that if you do have a fundamentally classical system, then it becomes very clear that you will have an emergence of classicality, and it's kind of end of story.
I'm okay for
this. Okay. Good. The second kind of motivation is that this theory naturally leads to information destruction, possibly with some nice behavior. So there's various thought experiments or various indications that tell you that you cannot have a theory which has fundamental information destruction. So there's a result by Banks, Peskin, and Susskind, which says that if I have a theory which fundamentally destroys information, then it must either be non-local or it must violate energy conservation. There's a few other results which suggest that having a theory which destroys information is very difficult. And this theory, I don't know if it gets around all those difficulties, but it opens up the possibility. So you'll see, I don't know if I'll have time to talk about it, but in this theory, you do have some violation of energy conservation, but it's much milder, and you can possibly even make some of it go away, because in people's arguments about looking at information destruction, there's not really been a discussion of doing it in gravity. So you can consider a toy theory where you just have information destruction, but what we really want to do is we want to have some back reaction on the gravitational field when we have information destruction. So this somehow has information destruction within gravity, and one sees that there may not be the same kinds of problems that Banks, Peskin, and Susskind uncovered. We might have time to discuss that more. Okay. So what I want to do is just ask the question, can we couple quantum and classical systems together? What are the no-go theorems and counter-arguments to that. And then I'll just discuss the general form that this dynamics can take. And then I will discuss how we can take that general form of this dynamics and apply it to general relativity in quantum field theory. Okay, so let's look at just this question of, can we couple a quantum system with a classical system? So this is the, I guess, the central kind of no-go theorem, which is or kind of thought experiment for why people want to, which I think motivates why people want to quantize gravity, is due to Feynman, and it's the following. We imagine we have a double slit experiment. We send a massive particle through the slit, so the massive particle will be in a superposition of taking one slit or the other, and will cause some interference pattern here. And now what we want to do is we want to measure the gravitational field that this particle produces. So the particle's in a superposition of left and right, say, left and right slit. And what we do is we set up a gravity wave detector, and we measure the, you know, or we just sit there with a little test mass and try and measure the gravitational field. And if we can measure it accurately enough, we'll know whether the particle went through this slit or that slit, because the gravitational field will be different if it goes through the left slit versus the right slit. And if we can successfully determine the gravitational field, then there will not be any interference pattern, right? Because we'll know which slit the particle went through. Is that thought experiment clear? Yeah. And so the argument goes that if gravity is classical, then there's no impediment to measuring with arbitrary accuracy the gravitational field, right? Because classical fields, I can measure exactly the value of the field, and so I can determine exactly which slit the particle went through. And so that's the main argument against it. Now, for a you can ask, what happens for a quantum field? So say I have an electron, and it produces a different electromagnetic field. And I can ask, you know, by measuring the electromagnetic field, can I determine which slit the electron goes through? And if I measure successfully which slit the electron goes through, then I won't see an interference pattern either. But the difference is, if the electromagnetic field, because it's quantum, I can't measure with precision all the values of the electromagnetic field, right? I can't, by making measurements on the electromagnetic field, I can't determine which slit the particle went through. I might get some information about which slit the particle went through, and if that happens, then there will not be a perfect interference pattern. But in general, if it's clean enough, and say, for, you know, if the electron, say, doesn't have to make huge deflections, then by measuring the electromagnetic field, we cannot determine which slit the electron went through, and so we still have an interference pattern. Does that argument make sense? Yeah? Anyone see it, like a hole in it? Bartek?
So the interference pattern basically tells us how much we have elsewhere observed about the trajectory of the particle.
That's right, yeah. So, and therefore? It tells you how much information is in, say, the gravitational field in this case. And I guess the idea is that this is why you naturally get stochasticity, why you naturally get information destruction, because the idea is that if your theory is deterministic, if you have if you try and deterministically couple a classical system to a quantum system, then that will not work because you will never see interference patterns, okay? If it's a deterministic coupling, because a deterministic coupling means that there will be a different gravitational field depending on what slit the massive particle went through. And so you'll be able to, there'll never be an interference pattern. But if the coupling is not deterministic, if there's some stochasticity, then you can indeed have a coupling to a classical field. So that's why we automatically get stochasticity.
You're saying that gravity destroys the particle virtuality. Maybe the word not destroy, but it does something to it. Particle virtuality is an experimental fact.
Yes.
That was that experiment.
Yes. No, I'm saying that if it was classical and deterministic, then it would destroy it. So we have to, if we're going to just explore the consequence of making gravity classical, then we necessarily must have a stochastic theory. Because we can't have classicality and determinism at the same time. If we have determinism, we must have, then we cannot couple a classical and quantum system together. Yeah? This is an unfair question.
Could it be that we just, in principle, can never measure that gravitational field, so that's why we can never see above and then different.
Right. Yeah. I guess you could ask, would it be classical? So I guess I define the notion of part of what I think of as classicality is we can measure everything exactly. So I have some phase space, and I can measure that. I can measure the system, I can measure the field. A classical field I think of as a field we can determine exactly. I guess you could have a classical system where for some reason there is a restriction on what you can know about that field, and then maybe there would be such a thing.
Yeah, the reason I ask is that I remember reading about the Hannah-Epley experiment.
Yes.
And then someone later went on to calculate how big the gravitational wave detector would have to be.
This is true, but I guess the thing is, so in the thought experiment, I'm using a gravity wave detector, or Epley and Hannah use a gravity wave, or I guess Feynman thought of a gravity wave detector, but you don't actually need to measure it for you to lose the interference pattern, right? If the information is in, if somehow there is information in the gravitational field which could be used even just analytically, like even just on, even if I just look at the equation and the state and I could determine which slit it went through, it necessarily has destroyed the interference experiment. Whether I can measure it or not is not an issue, is not part of the thing. Yeah?
One other point. If you interpret gravity as geometrical, then there can be uncertainty making geometrical measurements at small enough distances.
I think, though, I'm saying that
classically.
That's fine, but I guess what I'm saying is that if I were to try to write down the state of the system, the mere fact that it's coupled to something which is different, so I have, for example, left slit, and I don't even know how I'm going to write it, but I'm going to have something times something, so the gravitational field, let's just do it like a quantum slit system. So I have the gravitational field when the system's on the left plus right gravitational system, the gravitational field indicate, the gravitational field when this particle has gone through the right slit. If these things are orthogonal in whatever theory you have, whether it be classical or quantum, whether or not you can determine it, then this will not have any interference. So again, it doesn't matter whether you could measure those geometric, anything, whether you could actually perform those measurements. You just would not be able to write something which would have an interference pattern.
So if I understand correctly, you're assuming that space-time is classical, not as an approximation, but like you're assuming supposed to have, that fundamentally space-time is actually classical, right? My question is just because isn't it in regular quantum mechanics like X is already an operator, not a classical operator position. So how could it be that you assume? How could it be that that there is a fundamental theory of space time that's fundamentally classical? Classical and quantum.
I guess I mean here the metric. So I'm looking at a field. I imagine some manifold where I have points X, and then on that manifold, I have defined fields, quantum fields on that manifold, and then there's also a metric. And I'm asking, could that metric be classical? And could I couple it to a quantum field theory in a consistent way? And so I'm making, so there's various arguments which say that no, that metric has to be quantum if it's coupled to quantum fields. And what I'm saying is that if you have a stochastic coupling, it can be classical. So the electron, you know, the operator X still applies to the electron, whether it went through the left slit or the right slit. So that is still a quantum operator, but is now coupled to a classical gravitational field. And it can happen as long as there's information destruction, and so in the sense that the gravitational field cannot fully know or all the time know which slit the particle went through.
Could I ask you to repeat the statement about stochasticity that you made?
Yes. I will just be like, determinism, how do you, is it with a determinant? Plus, quantum field theory implies quantum gravity, or at least not implies no classical gravity. So, in other words, if I want to couple quantum field theory and classical gravity, then I have to get rid of determinism and have stochasticity. Yeah? So if I have a CQ theory, classical quantum theory, I necessarily have a stochastic, it has to be stochastic.
Are you proposing a stochastic theory?
Yes. Yeah. I don't generally believe in no-go theorems, but I believe in this one. So this is a way out of pretty much all the no-go theorems that people, and there's quite a lot of them. So I'm mentioning three there, but there's plenty more, and there's a discussion back and forth. Yeah.
So I'm just trying to understand this. So this thought experiment you're trying to tell us is that as long as my quantum system can couple with gravitational degree of freedom, that those eigenbases are like, they can be orthogonal to each other, then we don't have coherence anymore. At all in this world, we wouldn't observe any.
That's right.
The fact that we have coherence means that isn't like.
That means the fact that we have coherence either means that gravity is quantum, or it means gravity is classical but stochastic. So you're allowed stochastic gravity, you can have a stochastic coupling to classical gravity. I don't want to use it, stochastic coupling to gravity, coupling to classical gravity. or quantum gravity. So those are the two options. Or something else. So you can have these two things. But you can, there's plenty of people that have looked at deterministic couplings of classical systems with quantum ones. They all have problems. But if you are willing to get rid of, give up determinism, you're okay.
So I'm confused about two things. First, you might have covered this before I came in. It seems obvious that you'll have to have some stochastic behavior for the gravity, as long as the quantum matter is quantum. Because you can have a quantum event that will, you know, move a huge ultimate result in a large mass being over here. If the beam splitter goes one way and it'll result in the large mass being over here, if the beam splitter goes the other way, and then unless you believe that the gravitational field doesn't follow the mass, then you'll certainly have some probability of a gravitational field to be here and some probability for it to be here. So that's
I don't mean that kind of stochasticity. So there's obviously, you know, if I'm dealing with quantum mechanics, I necessarily am performing measurements which have probabilistic outcomes. But let's talk about, I want to think, I'm not talking about that, which is different.
I'm talking about a measurement as such. I'm just saying, set up something, you know, like a Schrodinger cat, where even if there was no measurement done, there'd be a certain amplitude of 1 over square root of 2 for a large mass to end up here, and an amplitude of 1 over square root of 2 for a large mass to end up.
Well, now we're talking amplitudes, and that's perfectly unitary. So quantum mechanics, would you...
Well, not...
I guess I want to say if quantum mechanics,
gravity would not be classical then. If it's just an amplitude for the gravitational field to be here, to be that of a mass here, and an amplitude for it to be that of a mass here, that wouldn't be classical. So if the gravitational field has to be classical, I'm just trying to amplify your point.
Okay.
It seems to me that it has to be stochastic. It has to behave stochastically. Maybe you're not accepting the argument, but it's leading to the same conclusion.
Okay. I'm not sure that I accept the argument, but I'm happy if you agree.
But then the second thing is that when you say stochastic coupling, is that claiming more than what I just said? I'm saying gravity must behave stochastically. But to say that it's coupled in a stochastic manner, maybe you'll show us explicitly what it means. But
I'll do that.
Okay.
I think it'll be maybe easier. I'm not able to. Yeah, I'm not sure that I can concretely write down the argument you're making. Although I understand the intuition, but I think I'm talking about a different kind of stochasticity. But maybe when you see the dynamics, that will be clear. Okay. Any other?
One more point.
Sure.
Experimental physics, one always encounters Brownian motion type stochasticity, some scale.
Mm-hmm.
So when you treat that as a like Langevin equation, fluctuations, it doesn't involve the square root of minus one.
Mm-hmm.
And quantum mechanics is very fundamentally involved with square root of minus one.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a way to tell between quantum mechanics and Brownian motion, stochastic.
Right. I totally agree with you.
And maybe the question is, does this occur in gravity, this distinction? Does the square root of minus one come in to gravity?
I agree. Yes, I would agree. I would endorse that. Okay. Let me give the second argument, another argument why. I would say people, it's a little bit crackpot, it's considered a bit crackpot, I think, to consider classical gravity coupled to quantum field theory. And so I feel a bit like I need to justify why it's not. And I think one of the reasons that it's considered a bit crackpot is because when people think of classical gravity coupled to quantum fields, they, especially general relativists, they automatically think of this equation here called the semi-classical Einstein's equation. And I'm not going to do something like, I'm not going to use this because it's pathological. But I just want to just go over a key point. So this is the equation people use when they want to understand the back reaction. So I have in Hawking's calculation or in an inflationary universe, I have some quantum fields, I have some density matrix, T mu nu, I can't do quantum gravity, so I want to understand what the back reaction is on classical, so this is the metric, this has the Einstein tensor, it has the information about the metric, and so what people do, because this is a C number, a classical system, this is a operator, it's a quantum system, and so the only way to make this at least consistent in the sense of number equals number or operator equals operator is, for example, is either to make this an operator or to make this a C number. And so what people do is they look at the expectation value of this operator because that's a C number. And that's clearly pathological. The reason is that if I, for example, imagine I flip a coin and if I get heads, I put a planet on the left. And if I get tails, I flip a coin. If I get tails, I put a planet on the right. Then if I look at the stress energy tensor, say, of this system, then what it looks like is it looks like the stress energy, it looks like half of a planet on the right. So the stress energy tensor of half a planet on the right. And half of a planet on the left. So looks something like this. Right. So if the source of the gravitational field is
half of a planet, I'll do this, half a planet on the left and half a planet on the right. So this, so it's, this was probability one half being on the left, probability one half of being on the right, looks like in this equation half a planet on the left and half a planet on the right at the same time. That's pathological. What will happen is these two half planets will be attracted to each other, which in the language of the coin toss means that if I got heads and the planet is on the left, it will fall to the place I would have put the planet if instead the heads, the coin had said tails, which of course is crazy because how could the planet move towards a place that, you know, how does it know where I would have put the planet if the coin had been tails? And also a test mass will just, in the system we have half a planet on the left and half a planet on the right, will just fall down the middle, right? So that, clearly the semi-classical Einstein equation is pathological. So I think that is one of the reasons why people think classical gravity is a little bit crackpot, but I'm not going to go there. And in fact, I guess what I would regard as, I think this part of the motivation for this research direction is that I think there's a big gap in how we analyze quantum systems coupled to gravity when we take the classical limit of at least the gravitational system. And the dynamics I will hopefully show you, I think, is a good way to look at that classical limit, all right? And analyze that back reaction. So even if you don't believe that fundamentally gravity is classical, even if you don't believe that information loss is fundamental, I think it's fairly clear that there is, at least it seems that, you know, there is certainly a classical limit where I can look at the classical limit of the gravitational field. And there's certainly, I think, a limit at low energies or for very large black holes where information destruction appears to happen. So we should try and understand at least this effective theory if we're going to have any hope of quantizing gravity. Yeah?
I just want to say that's exactly what I was talking about.
Okay.
So the only reasonable outcome is not half a gravitational, half a planet here. I mean, the gravitational field of half a planet here, but it should be either the planet here and the gravitational field here, or the planet here and the gravitational field here.
Okay.
Therefore, gravitational field is behaving stochastically because it has a 50% chance of looking like that of this planet and 50% chance of looking like that of this planet.
I guess I wouldn't call that stochastic in the way I'm thinking of, because there the stochasticity comes from the coin toss. So I've assumed here that the coin toss, that I, there's such a thing as a coin toss.
Quantum coin toss.
Well, this I was just doing a classical one, but.
No, then the expectation value won't be like that. It has to be the quantum expectation value.
Well, you know, for example, I could imagine having an entangled state of a coin. And so, you know, the planet left or right is entangled with the value of some coin, and now I measure the value of the coin.
If you measure, okay.
Yeah, so that's the kind of thing. So,
but I meant a quantum coin toss, and then I think the argument goes through.
I understand that, yeah, point of view. I'm not sure I agree with it, but I understand. Yeah. It's certainly a different kind of stochasticity than what I'm talking about, and I guess I feel that I could. I feel here the stochasticity is introduced by in some other way. Okay, but there may be some relation.
No, yeah.
Okay.
We'll see what your way is.
Sure. Any questions? Okay. So, what is the general form of this dynamics? How many people are familiar with Lindblad equations? Lindblad equations. Or completely positive trace preserving maps? Most people, almost everyone. Okay, so I'll do it quickly because it's, so what I find fun about this is I get to, you know, we get to redo some fundamental results in, I don't know if you want to call it quantum information theory, but precursor to quantum information theory. So We want to understand what is the most general dynamics we can have which couples classical systems to quantum systems, right? That seems like an interesting question. If there's no no-go theorems, we can ask, you know, what kind of dynamics can we have that will couple a classical system and a quantum system? So the first thing, you know, we have a notion of a quantum system, which would just be a density matrix. So trace one and positive. We have a quantum system. There's a classical system, classical system where we would have a probability distribution or a density matrix, a phase-based density. So we have a phase-based density in Q and P. And again, it's positive. And it integrates to one, so it's normalized. Can everyone see this okay? Okay. And you can derive either the Liouville equation, which is the equation that governs classical systems, or the Heisenberg equation, or the Schrodinger equation for quantum systems, or more general kinds of evolution laws by demanding, first of all, that that the dynamics takes a quantum state as input and gives you out a quantum state as output, right? Or takes a phase-based density and gives you back a phase-based density. So the dynamics has to at least do that, or something's gone wrong. Okay. And the other thing is it has to be linear for the reason that we discussed with the when we were talking about semi-classical gravity. It has to be linear because we shouldn't have that systems behave differently depending on what the result would have been if the coin had been tails, right? So it has to be linear and it has to preserve the state. So for a classical quantum state, what we have is we have a Hilbert space at each point in phase space, right? So I'm going to write it as some Varro QP. So we have a density matrix, so it's positive, but it's not, this thing doesn't have trace one, but it is still normalized. So if I integrate over the phase space and take the trace, then this equals one, right? So at every point in phase space, there's a quantum state living there. And the state of the system is represented by some density matrix. Sorry, there's a Hilbert space at every point in phase space, and the state space is just a point there where I have a subnormalized density matrix at each point in phase space.
So what goes wrong when you put a Dirac delta for the density in phase space? So when
nothing.
So
in a classical quantum theory.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's perfectly fine to have the state could be a delta function in Q and P. And then it would be a normalized state, quantum state sitting there. But the dynamics, as we discussed in the opening no-go theorems, can't be deterministic. So if this thing moves around in phase space, it's necessarily going to have to no longer be a Dirac delta function. So if it starts off in phase space at a particular point, then necessarily it must at some later time, if it's moving in this way, there'll be some dispersion. Necessarily. Is that your question?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there's necessarily has to have dispersion in phase space. In fact, it has to jump in phase space. So not only, so it turns out that its motion has to be, it'll have dispersion, but it will also hop. So it'll hop in discrete, it has to hop in discrete amounts. We'll get to that, I think. Yeah. Do people understand what this object is, though? Because that's the main thing, I think. So, if people are familiar with people from quantum information theory would understand this. So, I can imagine I have a quantum state which looks like this, right? It has a quantum state. It has two Hilbert spaces, Q and C. So we have a quantum state, and then we have some. So we have some quantum state, and then we have some classical space here. So here, Z would be the phase space. So I can imagine a state like this. Or let me just even. So we can have some state which looks like. This is a CQ state. It's called a classical quantum state. And we can imagine something like this. So it has probability of being at Z. So here we have a quantum state. Here we have this is how I would write a classical quantum object using a purely quantum formalism. So this is an orthogonal basis, so it has a definite Z. Z is a definite state. I could imagine that I'm only allowed to measure in the Z basis. I can't measure in a complementary basis. So if I'm only allowed to measure in the Z basis, then this is what a classical quantum or a hybrid state looks like. Is that clear? So for every Z, there is a quantum state. And that quantum state occurs with some probability, but that's just the probability of being at Z. Yeah.
So just to your previous picture, so you could start with a Dirac delta in both position and momentum, right?
It's really a classical phase space. So I can start off with a Dirac delta in Q and P. One of the systems that Barbara looked at was for example, the easiest system is a spin with a Q and a P. So Stern-Gerlach, like a particle which has a spin, and the spin is quantum. So you can imagine. So I'll cover one of these. So. So you can imagine that you have the easiest example is you have a spin. The spin is quantum, so it's represented by a quantum state. But it also has a Q and a P, and I can measure the Q and a P to arbitrary accuracy. So for example, a valid classical quantum state would be some Q, so it's sitting at a particular point in phase space, Q0 and P0. But then, it might have it has a particular quantum state for the spin, whatever that is. So that would be a pure classical quantum state. This might be spin up or plus or whatever. Does that answer the question? So it can have a direct, it has a definite Q and P, but its spin is just purely quantum.
Okay, so its Q and P is the position. Okay, so it's got like classical position degrees of freedom.
So this has classical degrees of freedom, position and momentum. It's like a point particle, but it also has a spin. The spin is treated quantumly. We treat the position and momentum classically. And, I should say there's applications for this in, people look at this in chemistry, this happens all the time. For some reason, they're happy with master equations, which are not completely positive, but.
I mean that you actually distinguish like some observable are just essentially classical observable and some observable that will be intrinsically corresponds to them.
That's right, exactly, yeah. So what I want to get to is that the gravitational field is intrinsically classical and the quantum fields are quantum. But you can think of any system like this where you break it up into classical and quantum degrees of freedom.
But why is this different from the semi-classical Einstein equations?
It's linear. Then I'll write a master equation which is perfectly linear. It doesn't have any of these pathologies. So, yeah.
But isn't it that the Einstein equations would be expectation values now with respect to this?
When the gravitational field is at Q naught, P naught, then it's at a particular value and the quantum fields live on that. So there's no expectation values here. Nice. Thanks, Albert.
I should take into account maybe that decoherence due to the environment, which forces quantum systems to be classical.
Yeah.
This is also true for your planets, because there's an environment that just causes decoherence. Forces you into classical physics.
Yeah, so like I said, one thing is that this may be a class, like a natural classical limit of a fully quantum theory. So there may be a quantum theory of gravity, but we want to take the classical limit. And
but that removes the pathology.
What pathology?
The semi-classical Einstein equation.
Yeah, so when people, for example, so in some sense, when people say they're doing semi-classical Einstein's equation, what they're often doing is what you say, which is that they're, you know, for example, in inflation, you imagine the field has a particular value and you use that. So it's almost like you condition on the value of the quantum field because then you treat it classically. So you're treating the quantum field classically. You say it has a different value and then we look at the Biak reaction. But that's a bit of, in my view, it's fine for what they're doing, but it's not really quantum field coupled to a classical system in any way.
There's a problem with quantum computers. They get destroyed by particular.
Sure. Yeah, I guess that when I mentioned that this kind of notion of collapse of the wave function, that you automatically get it, and you know, decoherence is not fundamental. The information is sitting there somehow in the electromagnetic field, but here, because the gravitational field is classical, here when the gravitational field does learn which slit it went to, then that's a kind of a fundamental decoherence in the sense that it's a matter of fact whether the particle went through the left slit or the right slit. There's no kind of many worlds interpretation. It went through the left slit or the right slit because you're able to determine which slit it went to by measuring the gravitational field, which is classical and real. And determined perfectly. So that's where you get the notion of collapse of the wave function emerging. It's 4:30 already.
It is
4:30. We did the same thing. We did the same thing.
Up the tempo a little bit.
Yeah.
And we'll see. I mean, we'll have to leave it somewhere.
Okay. So I guess what I'll just say is, because I think most of you know that if I have a quantum system, I can ask some nice questions that we all learned in our quantum information class, like, what is the most general dynamics that I can have on a quantum system? And we know that it must be completely positive and trace preserving because it must preserve the state, right? It has to be completely positive, trace preserving. And I can ask the same thing with this hybrid object. I can say, what's the most general dynamics that I can have? It has to preserve normalization. It has to completely positive again. And so I can ask these questions, what's the most general dynamics which preserves the state and is linear? And in quantum information theory, we find that for purely quantum systems, the most general dynamics is given by the Krauss representation theorem. So I'll just throw some things. So for quantum systems, we'll see. For quantum systems, you have that you can write the dynamics in terms of Krauss operators. In classical dynamics, what you would have is that you can write the final probability distribution in terms of a conditional probability kind of channel. And here you find something very similar but more complicated. Maybe people are more familiar with the, if you then, how much time should I, how much up the tempo should I give?
So if we have another 20 minutes, are people okay with that? I guess if people have to leave, then they'll leave.
Okay, there's some frightened looks.
Okay. Good. So
I'll try and keep it 15 tops, 10
okay,
50. Is that okay?
And
okay. Oh, good. So in, Right, so for quantum systems, if we want to keep a quantum system, the dynamics has to look like this. It's called the Krauss representation theorem. So I have these operators which sum to the identity, whereas for a classical system, again, if I integrate the state, it has to sum to one, which similar to the Krauss operators having to sum to the identity, if I want to know what the probability is at some later time, t, then that equals, I should have had a sum there, the probability that it was at some other place in phase space, q prime, p prime, and then I have a transition matrix, like a channel. I guess I would sum over q prime, p prime. So this is how this is the most general stochastic classical dynamics that I can have. And what we do is we combine them. So you can combine them and show that that's the most general classical quantum dynamics you can have, which preserves the state. If I then make a big assumption that the dynamics is memoryless or Markovian, then in the quantum case, I get the Lindblad equation. So I think most of you had seen this before. So the Lindblad equation, you have the usual Hamiltonian commutator, so the usual Heisenberg part, that's the deterministic part. And then I have a stochastic part, which, you know, John was mentioning decoherence, so it can be used to model decoherence. It can be used to model any kind of information destruction or dynamics which is not deterministic, but is still preserves probabilities, which is what this dynamics needs to do. It needs to make sure that probabilities get mapped to probabilities, right? Quantum states get mapped to quantum states. So you can easily see that this kind of a dynamics, the Lindblad equation, preserves a quantum state. Is that good? How many people are happy with this? Okay. And likewise for classical systems, you have this, I think it's called the Pauli equation, but I can't imagine it wasn't known until Pauli, but I want to know what the probability is of the particle being at a point in phase space. So there's the usual deterministic part, the Liouville equation part. And then I have a stochastic part, which just says that if it is at some other point in phase space, it's going to hop. Maybe there's some probability it's at q prime, p prime, and then there's some rate that it'll hop to being at q and p, right? So this is here, this represents, so I want to know what's the probability of the state being at this point in phase space. And it's given by the probability that it's at some other point and moves there, moves from q prime, p prime to q and p. And I just sum these all up. So it's all the incoming fluxes that I sum up. So there's the rate of the particle moving to q and p. And then I subtract something off, which is, in some sense, the rate at which it will leave. So it's the rate. The probability flux at this point is just given by the rate of particles coming, oh, sorry, the rate of phase space points moving in minus the rate of phase space points moving out. Okay? Incoming probability flux versus the outgoing probability flux. I just subtract those. Is that clear? And then there is this classical quantum equation, which I didn't come up with it. Actually, it's been known since 93 by Blanchard and Jalik. It's even been studied in the context of gravity by Dioshi and by Poulin. It combines these two. So you have a quantum, what's sometimes called a quantum jump, meaning there is some probability that the particle gets hit by the quantum state changes because it gets hit by a Lindblad operator. And when that happens, it jumps in phase space. So you have a quantum jump combined with a movement in phase space. And that's an allowed dynamic. And this operator here, this function, has to be positive in order for the quantum classical state to remain a quantum classical state. So this is the most general kind of dynamics you can have, which is memoryless and which keeps a classical quantum state a classical quantum state. Is there any questions about that?
Yes. So yeah. Now you have defined the dynamics for one choice of time. But in general relativity, there is, of course, an infinite number of possible choices of time.
Yes.
So by taking commutators, I would suppose that you get some conditions on some further conditions.
Indeed.
For this dynamics to be consistent with general relativity. So what are these?
Right.
Are there such conditions? And
yeah, so we work in the ADM formulation. So we imagine that we start off with the state, the quantum state defined on a particular slice, and we're allowed to choose whatever coordinates we want, whatever lapse and shift we want. And then we have some dynamical evolution equation. And now, I guess this notion that you're saying of time, you know, there's no preferred notion of time, there's no preferred coordinate system. So what we need is that it needs to be invariant under, say, our choice of lapse and shift. So it has to be gauge invariant. And there's some, you can show that there are some, the conditions which are required for that to be true, and in GR, they're just the constraints. And here you get a modified set of constraints by demanding some kind of gauge invariance. Is that?
But you have not told us this.
I have not. It is in the paper. I could spend time on that, or I could. Why don't
you continue with it?
Okay. So I feel like I could first. What I could do is just quickly give the thing for a qubit, and then I'm happy to sit and actually show what the constraints look like. Okay. But effectively, you want that you have some algebra, and you want that algebraoid, and you want that to be main. This thing to close, and when you demand that this thing closes, you get the momentum constraint. And if you then demand that the momentum constraint is conserved in time, you get the Hamiltonian constraint. That's roughly.
The conditions on W? Or?
No, there are actually conditions on the state. Okay. I'll give this example, which is, so I guess the next thing you need to do, I'll just say, is that this just is a general form of the dynamics, and this far I've done nothing at all, this has been known, but now what you want to do is you want to apply it to gravity or apply it to actually any system which has some Hamiltonian. You want to have, as a classical limit, classical gravity, or you want to have, you know, a classical kind of Stern-Gerlach measurement. There's a way of, you know, there's a form of this dynamics which will allow you to apply it to a dynamical system. So I've called it kind of a non-commuting Hamiltonian dynamics, or there's like this non-commuting divergence. An example is easier since we're a specific example rather than general form. Can people see that? Okay, it's a bit small, isn't it? Yeah, sure.
I had a brief question on your general framework.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that the point in place must jump? There's no limit of this in which it follows some sort of continuous Brownian path?
Yeah. It's because it needs to remain positive. So. This function needs to remain positive, and so for that you need to have a finite size jumps. I don't have a concrete, like I don't have a watertight proof, but we have an almost watertight proof.
You might think there's some limit in which the jumps get smaller and smaller.
Yeah. So if that is possible, then there would be some approximation to this theory, where you have. Turns out. If you take this dynamics here, so you can take this dynamics here. If there's a continuous dynamics, then I can do a Taylor expansion in that small parameter, right? There's like I can just look at very small jumps. So I can Taylor expand this thing. And so I will get a moment which effectively looks like Looks like this. H, alpha, beta. Here's a, so I'll get stuff which looks like this, for example. So this is like, this looks like die H, die Q. So this is like P dot or something like that, right? So you get terms in your master equation which looks like this, if you have a continuous dynamics. And notice that this thing is not positive definite. Oh, sorry, this has a, this will be, so this is like a P dot, so this will have a die rho die P here. So because this thing can be positive or negative, is not positive definite, then this thing becomes negative and you have negative probabilities. So it's very difficult to keep probabilities positive. And in order to keep probabilities positive, you have to have these finite hops. Surprising. So here's a toy model, which is a Stern-Gerlach. So you basically have, this will be the classical quantum hybrid object. So it's a qubit with a Q and a P, okay? And we have the quantum evolution. So we have, like, let's say, I don't know, sigma z, pick your favorite, the purely quantum part. We can have a purely classical part. So we could have a, you know, this thing moves in some potential, for example. So we could have something like, plus, what did I say, P over M. So this is the kinetic part. Well, let's just write it, I'll write it like this. So we have some purely classical part, which is a Poisson bracket. Is that legible? No. You have a Poisson bracket, which is like the classical part. You have the quantum part, which you can think of as like quantum field theory in curved space. So this is just the purely quantum evolution, and there's no classical dynamics. You have the purely classical dynamics, where, you know, that's fine as well. That's easy to do. We can easily have classical, you know, GR, where the classical gravity just evolves without being influenced by the matter. This is like quantum field theory in curved space, where the quantum system evolves by itself.
You really mean without being influenced by the matter? Sorry, when you said the gravitational field.
So it's very easy to do quantum field theory in curved space. So for example, I could have this. So let me, I could, for example, very easily write a Hamiltonian which depends on Q and P, and I could couple it to a quantum system. So this is a very easy thing to do. It's like a quantum system which is externally controlled by classical. So that's very easy to do, where the quantum system is influenced by, quantum system is influenced by the classical system. What's hard is the other way around. How do I get a quantum system to influence a classical system? So this is the purely, this is the quantum field theory in curved space. This is just the classical evolution due to pure gravity. So pure gravity without matter, that's easy to do as well. And now the hard part is, how do I get a quantum system to determine the classical evolution without, and still be, you know, valid? And so that's this coupling here. So for example, for the spin, I have that if it's spin up, it's going to move in one direction. So up. So here is the Lindblad operators, which are decohering it in the up basis. And here's the state, which is going to jump and get a kick in momentum given by some tau beta. And then if the spin is down, it's going to get a kick in the other direction. So I did it. Yeah. So if the spin is down, so we have down Lindblad operators, it's going to get a kick in momentum, but in the opposite direction. I'll end now so that people can go. So this is an example of a classical quantum coupling. And then I have the normalization factor, which is just omega over 2 tau, which is omega over tau rho. Okay. So here we have that if it's spin up, it gets a kick in momentum in the plus direction. If it's spin down, it gets a kick in the negative direction. And so the quantum system is basically pushing it along in momentum. And this dynamics is completely positive trace preserving. So it's completely valid. What happens, though, is there's only some probability of this happening. So what happens is it'll, you know, this particle moves along, and then with some probability given by omega over tau, it will get a kick in momentum one way or the other, depending on what value of spin is. Yeah?
How do you control
how much it breaks Lorentz symmetry? So it doesn't.
Obviously, pre-formed frame.
So there is a Lorentz, you can do the full, so the, I'm just doing, this is just a particle, you can do a full field theory this way. So what we first have to do is go from a quantum system to a quantum field theory, and then we want to go from a classical phase space to have the gravitational degrees of freedom, which are, again, a field theory. And there, one can have a Lorentz, you know, if you do it in a field theory way, you can have a Lorentz covariant theory.
So this kind of quantum control of the classical system,
yes,
in a sense, is still mediated classically, right? Because it seems like you're measuring the quantum system in a basis, and depending on the outcome of that measurement, you're doing something to the classical system. So would it be possible? It would presumably be hard without producing loads of noise to have, you know, if it's up, do this, and if it's plus, do this other thing without breaking something.
Yeah, this very simple model you can think of like, you know, there's a probability. Well, not all of them you can look at the, like this. So if these are just, there's a way of looking at some of these equations where, you know, I can imagine someone measures, waits a while and with some probability decides to make a measurement. And if they make a measurement, then they give a kick one way or a kick another way. And they may or may not make a measurement. So some of these equations you can think of like that.
But not all of them.
No. Because in general, the rate at which you're measuring depends on quantum, is a quantum variable.
Chris, can you read the illegible things?
Here, this is the Poisson bracket. So
I see it's a Poisson, but what is the first?
So it's the Hamiltonian. So you have a quantum. So what you do is you have a quantum Hamiltonian. Let's just write the general. I wrote sigma z, but really, let's write. We have some quantum system, H. Of Q and P, so that's the control, you know, the quantum Hamiltonian, which depends on the phase space variables. Then I can have a purely classical Hamiltonian. That would be like the pure gravity Hamiltonian. So that's classical. So for example, the ADM Hamiltonian. And then I have something which couples the gravitational degrees of freedom to the quantum degrees of freedom, but it has to do it via this Lindblad-y kind of thing, where there's some stochasticity.
So the question was, you ended up with a equation of motion for this mixed classical quantum density.
Yes.
That's not yet a trajectory for the classical system. So the question is, does this lead to a unique trajectory for the classical system? And if so, what is the nature of that trajectory?
Right. So you're lucky. Barbara Sodas is here at Perimeter. She's actually done an unraveling, unraveling the master equation. So that's what she's done, and so she can tell you the trajectory of any system via what you know this unraveling of a master equation. And what you find is that depending, you know, I can write a theory where. The quantum state stays pure, and the classical trajectory is probabilistic. So that kind of thing can happen.
But what's the nature of the trajectory? Does it have actual disk jumps?
Yes.
Is it discontinuous trajectory? Where are the discontinuities?
So for gravity, it's the momentum. So I'm going to wrap up, and then I would love to talk to you. But in gravity, it's that the classical degrees of freedom are not Q and P, but they're the three metric on a manifold, and the conjugate to the three metric, and the jumps are in the conjugate to the three metric. Whereas, yeah.
Well, can you
so can we, maybe we can just let Jonathan wrap up and then...
Okay.
Yeah, I'll just wrap up with the headline message, which is that, yes, you can have a classical system coupled to a quantum system. Yes, you can make it dynamical, so you can construct what I've called this non-commuting finite difference evolution law, which you can then apply to any dynamical system where you separate out classical degrees of freedom and quantum degrees of freedom. So you can apply to gravity. It necessarily leads to collapse of the wave function. It necessarily causes information destruction. And even if it's not fundamental, it provides a way to study the back reaction of quantum fields on classical degrees of freedom. Thank you for your attention.
So anyone who needs to get off should feel free to leave. And we'll take a few questions.
Hi. Can I ask a quick conceptual question?
Yeah.
What happens when matter collapses to form a black hole? And what happens when a black hole evaporates? Or does it evaporate? Oh, excuse me.
So I have no idea. I guess what I can say is that my rough guess is that there is a, because of the so I can have a system where the quantum state is pure conditioned on the gravitational degrees of freedom. So my feeling is that it's the actual gravitational degrees of freedom which are giving you the black hole entropy. And that's really all I can say, I suppose. The problem is that the equations are actually incredibly difficult to figure out.
The classical variables are the GAB and the PIABs.
Yes, that's right.
So that's kind of staying fixed in the sense that you can't convert between matter degrees of freedom and geometric degrees of freedom.
What do you mean convert between matter degrees of freedom?
What I mean is that...
So for example, you know, one thing we've looked at in a lot of detail is I have a classical metric, the conjugate thing, and then I look at a scalar field on this thing. So I have a scalar field with, you know, your normal Hamiltonian, and then I look at the action of the Hamiltonian on here, and it produces jumps in this thing and has very complicated constraints that you need to satisfy. I'm happy to show you in more detail what the, but I guess I feel like we're not quite at the level where we can, the equations are difficult to work out and find a solution for. But that's my intuition, at least that's what can happen. So you can have that you have some dispersion in some sense in pi, which necessarily gives you an entropy.
Comment on how wave function collapse emerges in this formalism, because like the Lindblad equation would give you decoherence, but how exactly does collapse?
So there's two ways it happens. There's this dynamical collapse, which is happening here. So here, for example, you see that, you know, if it's up, it will have there's a different imprint in the classical field compared to when it's down. So that necessarily will give you collapse in the sense that if it starts off in the plus state, then it will collapse to the up or the down state, and it will jump it'll get a momentum kick in the plus direction or a momentum kick in the minus direction. So that, in that way, in this dynamical way, you're necessarily getting the plus state collapsing to up or down. In the gravitational system, it's more complicated than that because you have the constraint equation. So there, most of the collapse comes, or not even collapse, it just comes that you cannot have superpositions because of the constraint equations.
Yeah, maybe we should stop at least because I think the guy is still recording and
okay.
Form the talk here and thank one more time.
Okay, thanks.
And,